The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So I want to thank everyone for what's been such an awesome conference this year, and I hope everyone got a little more sleep than I did. But if you didn't, I hope it's because the discussions were like that engaging and important that you felt like you just had to stay up. And Ida B. Wells would have absolutely been there debating with us. So Ida B. Wells was born a slave in 1862. And by the time she came of age, slavery had been abolished, and all the possibilities of equality and justice were blown wide open. She was part of a generation of people who experienced an upending of an old dying system and all the expectations that came with ushering in something different. But interestingly, she actually wasn't radicalized by legal freedom. She was radicalized by the reality of what freedom actually meant in the contested South after the war. Oppression was alive and well, and the battle for legal protection was forced upon freedmen and women even after slavery was abolished. So in this session, I'm going to go through her story, the story of Ida B. Wells, the political context that shaped her, and the different political arguments that she contested with. It's by no means exhaustive. There's so much to say, and it's such a rich history, and I feel like I can't quite do justice to the force that was Ida B. Wells in this talk. But she absolutely dedicated her life to exposing and confronting lynching, which she saw as an outgrowth of the social inequality and political disenfranchisement of African Americans. And I actually think there's a lot that we can learn for our fights against racism today, and our fights for a revolutionary transformation of society from Ida B. Wells. So after emancipation, Wells' parents rushed at every opportunity to educate themselves, and they tried to participate in every single political right that they had won. They were a part of new schools that opened for freed black men and women, where they learned to read and write for the first time, freedmen societies that organized aid, and all kinds of activities to try and uplift their race. In the fall of 1867, James Wells, Ida B. Wells' father, along with 60,000 black men and 50,000 white men, registered to vote for the very first time in Mississippi. I forgot to say, she's from Holly Springs, Mississippi. Voters elected 100 delegates, 67 Republicans, which was still the party that had been on the side of abolition, 17 of which were African Americans, to serve at the Constitutional Convention. In January, they put a new state constitution forward. It accepted the requirement of the 14th Amendment to abolish slavery. It disenfranchised ex-Confederates. It granted universal male suffrage, and it allowed interracial marriages. But there would be no honeymoon for these reforms and these proposals. The backlash happened immediately. In racist protest, a group of leading white men in Jackson wrote a white supremacist manifesto in which they resolved to defend the state against what they called Negro domination. They said in their manifesto, "The Republican Party is plotting to place the white man of the southern states under the governmental control of their late slaves. We call upon the people of Mississippi to vindicate alike the superiority of their race over the Negro and their political power, and to maintain constitutional liberty." They waved this banner of white supremacy, and they rallied the Democratic Party to try and organize and defeat this constitutional referendum by any means necessary. It was a mass campaign that tried to intimidate this new political force from participating in the new spaces for politics that were emerging. Among the tactics they used were to try and deny or put in jeopardy the wages of new black workers. Ida's father, James Wells, was threatened by his employer, who told him that he would be fired if he didn't vote for a Democrat. And he said, "Fuck you," and he quit. And he actually happened to be a master carpenter who had a lot of opportunities for work. But for most black men in this moment, disobeying their white employers would actually mean starvation. Like they were being faced with either you do what we say politically, or you will starve to death. Among the circumstances that led to the failure of radical Reconstruction was that without land distribution, African Americans were unable to develop an economic base for their newly acquired political rights. It was incredibly rare for black families to own any property or to own their own business. Despite a year-long campaign and battle, the Democratic campaign of terror succeeded, and the new progressive state constitution was defeated in 1868. This is something that Wells wrote in her diary reflecting on this. She said, "I have firmly believed all along that the law was on my side, and would, when we appealed to it, give us justice. I feel shorn of that belief and utterly discouraged, and just now, if it were possible, I would gather my race in my arms and fly away with them. So this is the political context that we have to understand the rise of lynching in the New World in. Curtailing the developments that had brought tens of thousands of black and white people into political participation meant reasserting a society divided by class, segregated by race, and restricted by sex. Democrats used extra-legal campaigns of physical and psychological intimidation to break up the alliances between black and white farm workers, and they aimed to keep people in what they deemed their proper places, aka the places of slavery. It would take until the civil rights movement to cast the shadow of these policies aside through though, as we have seen, there's been new forms of violence and racism that ultimately replaced them, and I'm sure people have been at sessions this weekend that have taken up some of those. To come back to Ida B. Wells' biography, at 16, there was a yellow fever epidemic that swept across the South, and this was the worst disaster of this kind in urban history up to that point. Over 20,000 people died, including her parents. But she assumed head of household, basically. Her father's friends had a plan to kind of separate her five siblings and put them in different houses and take care of her. And she was insistent that she wanted to keep her family together. She wanted to provide for her family. She found work as a teacher and she cared for her siblings. They soon relocated to Memphis to live with her father's sister-in-law, whose husband had also died in this epidemic. Her ability to work and to procure what was needed for herself and for her family gave her an independence that was incredibly uncommon for young women in this time. She passed an exam and she got a job in a public school, integrating herself into the incredibly active and engaged African-American community of Memphis. In 1884, when she was in transit to work, this was 71 years before Rosa Parks sparked the Montgomery bus boycott by refusing to go to the back of the bus, Ida B. Wells staged her own fight against segregated seating on the train. She was forcibly removed from the ladies' coach. The way that gender and race played out, black women were hardly considered ladies. And she fought back. She bit the conductor. She was pulled out literally civil disobedience style from this train car. And she actually sued the railroad company, and she won. But the decision was overturned by the Tennessee Supreme Court soon after. And this was really what sparked her to write her first political articles. She wrote an editorial about the ordeal, and it was such an incredible piece that she was asked to write a regular column for the weekly religious newspaper in Memphis. She wrote about the conditions and problems that faced African Americans, and 5 years later she actually became the co-owner of the Free Speech and Headlight, establishing herself as an unapologetic journalist for her people. In 1892, something would happen that changed her, that changed Ida B. Wells forever. And this is really what led her on her mission to expose lynching in the South. Three of her very close friends were murdered by politically fueled and brutal lynch mob. Thomas Moss, Henry Stewart, and Calvin McDowell were owners of a collectively run black grocery just outside of Memphis called the People's Grocery. On Wednesday, March 2nd, 1892, there was a scuffle outside the store. It was a game of marbles that a white boy and a black boy were playing, and soon enough, the father of the white boy is beating up the black child, and Stewart and McDowell run out of the supermarket to come to the boy's defense. And this put a target on their back. They became increasingly worried about being attacked by a mob because of having defended this black child. And they consulted a lawyer who told them, you guys should probably prepare to defend yourselves because you're outside city limits. There's literally nothing we can do. That's you go to a lawyer and they're like, sorry, there's no law. And there were actually warrants put out for their arrest for this incident. And six armed white police officers in plain clothes, including the sheriff, came to ransack and arrest these men on March 5th. The workers, not knowing that these were police officers because they're wearing plain clothes, shot at the attackers in attempted self-defense. The report said that once they found out that they actually were police officers, they put down their weapons and surrendered to arrest, expecting that they would have the opportunity to plead their case in court. The officers, none of the officers died. A couple of them were wounded. And Ida B. Wells actually later pointed out that this was the fact that they didn't die was the catalyst for the lynch mob, because they argued that now these men couldn't legally be executed for murder under the law, and that punishment, without that punishment, it just wasn't enough. So 75 men surrounded the Shelby County Jail, and they kidnapped these three men. The reports of the lynching in the white paper was so gruesome and so detailed that it was obvious that the reporters had actually been a part of the lynch mob. They had details that just you couldn't have known if you weren't there. They literally shot these men like every inch of their body. Their bodies were in pieces. And Thomas Moss's dying words, and he was Ida was particularly close to him. She was actually the godmother of his children, and they were. They organized together, they you know, lived near each other. His dying words were, "Tell my people to go west, there is no justice here for them." And this was such a seminal and radicalizing moment for Ida. From this moment on, she never saw the United States the same way ever again. She began to ask why lynching happens, and she would spend the rest of her life exposing the reality and the lies that upheld lynch law. Immediately, she went to work writing articles to condemn these lynchings and calling for organized black protest and self-defense. And she was incredibly radical. She went way further than anyone else of her time. This is a quote from the first editorial she wrote. "A Winchester rifle should have a place of honor in every black home, and it should be used for the protection which the law refuses to give." So she was calling for armed self-defense in the face of lynchings. And for this, the lynch mobs came after her. She actually happened to be in New York City when they came to her, the office of her newspaper, but they destroyed her office and they promised to torture her and murder her if she ever came back to Tennessee. She was exiled in her own country. It would be 3 decades until she would ever step foot in the South again. But in her exile, her crusade against lynching was launched. In her autobiography, she wrote, "Having lost my paper, had a price put on my life, and been made an exile from my home for hinting at the truth, I felt that I owed it to myself and to my race to tell the whole truth now that I was where I could do it freely." Before this incident, Ida B. Wells was disgusted by lynching, but she had also accepted a lot of the dominant narratives about it. In particular, the most common, and the one that I'm sure people are familiar with, is that lynching happens because of white men raped by black women. This is a quote from her before this whole incident that she wrote in her diary. She said, "It seems awful to take a human life, but hardly more so than to take a woman's reputation and make it the jest and byword of the street. In my view of these things, if he really did them, one is strongly tempted to say his killing was justifiable." And this was the most common understanding of how people approach lynching at this time. As early as 1883, Frederick Douglass was the first to speak out strongly against what absolutely is shown to be a myth of a black rapist. And he said, "A crime almost unknown to the colored man in the time of slavery seems now, from report, the most common. I do not believe these reports. There are too many reasons for trumping up such accusations." So this was in 1883. Wells' ideas changed from the quote that I had read before, and she became well beyond Frederick Douglass the most vocal, poignant voice against lynching after the upsurge of racial violence in the 1890s. The mob violence that accompanied the populist revolt made clear to some black and white that lynching had more to do with preventing black political and economic mobility than protecting white women from rape. The Memphis lynching revealed to Ida how little lynching had to do with raping white women in a very concrete sense. It was actually economic competition, not rape, that caused their deaths. She knew these men. They did everything they were supposed to do. They were noble, like, model citizens. They worked, they participated in the cooperative, in their community. They had harmed no one, and still they were lynched. In her autobiography, she wrote, "Thomas Moss, Calvin McDowell, and Lee Stewart had been lynched in Memphis, one of the leading cities of the South, in which no lynching had taken place before, with just as much brutality as other victims of the mob, and they had committed no crime against white women. This opened my eyes to what lynching really was, an excuse to get rid of Negroes who were acquiring wealth and property, and thus keep the race terrorized and keep us down." Wells wrote a series of articles, and in particular a pamphlet called Southern Horrors, that went through the origins of lynching and an explanation of it. And she rooted it in the antebellum South and to the race, gender, and class dynamics of slavery. It's important to to repeat that lynching as a phenomenon of racial domination didn't exist under slavery. And there's a pretty simple reason. It's because under slavery, a slave owner's slave, a human being, is their property. And there's just no material reason why you would damage your property, the instrument through which you extract wealth. And then there's a flip side to that too, which is that black women, also property, human women, property, there's no such thing as consent as a black slave. You're owned by your master, and he can do what he likes under the slavery. So under freedom, now that there's freedom, freed slaves were experienced a new type of violence. Before the Civil War, lynching would happen mostly against whites for political or social questions. British loyalists in the 18th century, those with unpopular political positions, and it's not till the 1890s, for the first time, the majority of victims of lynching are black, and they were happening with increasing frequency. And this is a quote from Ida B. Wells from Southern Horrors. She said, "In slave times, the Negro was kept subservient and submissive by the frequency and severity of the scourging." But with freedom, a new system of intimidation came into vogue. The Negro was not only whipped and scourged, he was killed. From the end of the Civil War in 1865, Reconstruction had been a positive force in the lives of black men and women. Federal troops provided some semblance of protection against white terror, and the last of these troops were pulled in 1877, which accelerated the erosion of the gains that were made in the previous 8 years. And this is when lynching becomes a tool of oppression against African Americans. Between 1882 and 1892, lynching against African Americans increased by 200%. In 1882, 46% of lynchings were against African Americans. In 1900, 89% of lynchings were against African Americans. And even in this hell, African Americans never stopped fighting for voting rights, for civil rights, for the realization of freedom. But the Black Codes and Jim Crow firmly reinscribed boundaries between whites and blacks and controlled their social, political, and economic lives in ways that endured until the gains of the civil rights movement. Ida B. Wells was one of the first to explain the true roots of lynching and to refuse to concede that even a little bit was it in retaliation of sexual violence of black men. She systematically gathered statistics to refute the dominant ideology that even the major largest black organizations of her time accepted a lot of these dominant ideologies. She knew that to build a successful campaign would require exposing the absurdity of the dominant argument, and linked it to a campaign not only against lynching but also against rape. The contours of her argument, I wish I could do them justice. I really want to encourage people to actually read what she wrote, because she does it with such detail and such clarity that I can't do justice to. But she starts by crediting Frederick Douglass, and she makes a comprehensive argument that the charge of rape of white women was used to justify mob violence in order to terrorize, oppress, and control newly freed slaves. Before that, in the immediate post-Reconstruction era, lynching was said to be needed to repress alleged race riots in order to protect whites from black uprising. But once disenfranchisement had become the reality, it was very hard for that narrative to continue. And so it now switched to being lynching is necessary to protect white women. And that is how the dominant ideology around lynching was perceived. During Reconstruction, the whole script on racial and sexual violence was flipped from what it had been during slavery, and it served to justify segregation and disenfranchisement. Wells demonstrates how effective lynch law was at controlling the behavior not only of African American men, not only of African American women, but also of white women. She made a highly researched and impassioned case that asserts that lynching was not a punishment for the heinous crime of rape, but a heinous act of terrorism and oppression itself. And in fact, like her friends who were killed by the lynch mob in Memphis, the crimes committed were actually achievements. Others were lynched for voting, for speaking publicly about African American advancement, or for having a particularly prosperous or successful business. Far from being a response to black rapists, the fact pointed to something else. Black women actually suffered sexual violence at the hands of white men who were never lynched. So the idea that this is about protecting women was a farce. Despite all these calls that like womanhood needs to be protected. Black women not only were victimized, but were also blamed over and over again for the very crimes that were committed against them, for being called promiscuous, unladylike, not worthy of defense. And on the other hand, Ida B. Wells shows that there's actually a lot of well-documented evidence of consensual relationships between black men and white women, where the man, despite it being a consensual relationship, was lynched for being in an interracial couple. She asserted that black women suffered sexual violence at the hands of white men, and black men were murdered by white mobs for consensual relationships with white women. Through her statistics, she showed that rape was not even an accusation in the vast majority of lynching cases. In fact, the word was only even used as part of the crime in 1/3 of lynchings. She challenged the notion that men were defending their women out of chivalry and exposed the contradiction of how black women are not treated as women. This is a quote from her from Southern Horrors. "Not one who reads the record as it is written in the faces of the millions of mulattoes in this South will for a minute conceive that the Southern white man had a very chivalrous regard for the honor due to the woman of his own race or respect for the womanhood which circumstance placed in his power." This was part of her own family story. Her mother had been a slave and talked about how her slave master took whatever he wanted. This is a quote that he seared her flesh and her mind with torturous beatings. And her father was the product of a white slave master and a slave mother. Ida B. Wells was dead set on exposing the hypocrisy of quote-unquote Southern values. To defend African American people from mob violence, she had to dismantle the predominant stereotypes that were based on gender and on race. And she suggested that white women were not being violated, but were actually willing partners, and that black women should not be blamed for their own victimization. I kind of just repeated what I said before, but she took great detail in detailing the contradictions and the lies, hoping they would expose the reality to the world, and that once those were exposed, that reality would have to be changed. And she linked all of this to a political argument for mass action. This is kind of a longer quote, but it's the argument that she puts forward for what African Americans and their supporters should do to actually have an impact on lynching. I think it's interesting. She said, "In the creation of this healthier public sentiment, the African American can do for himself what no one else can do for him. The world looks on with wonder that we have conceded so much and remained law-abiding under such great outrage and provocation. To Northern capital and African-American labor, the South owes its rehabilitation. If labor is withdrawn, capital will not remain. The African-American is the backbone of the South. A thorough, knowledgeable, and judicious exercise of this power in lynching localities could many times affect a bloodless revolution. The white man's dollar is his god. And to stop this will be to stop outrages in many localities." And later on in the chapter, she says, "Nothing is more definitively settled than that he must act for himself. I have shown how he may employ the boycott, immigration, and the press, and I feel that by a combination of these agencies can be effectually stamped out lynch law, the last relic of barbarism and slavery." So she actually had a strategy and a political argument for how black men and women could exercise their rights. She hoped her writing would spur people into action, and she intended for them to be widely accessible. She wrote in her autobiography that she never used a word of two syllables where one would serve its purpose. It was intended to actually be used and by as many people as possible. After Frederick Douglass, she was the very first to articulate these positions on lynching that looked at the question not as an issue of gender, race, and class, but actually located them in the economic gains of newly freed African Americans. And for the most part, I mentioned this, but I want to go more into it, that her black contemporaries accepted a lot of the myths about the black rapist. The most common outlook was to downplay the role of white Southerners and turn critiques inward on the need for racial uplift in order to be accepted as equals, and that would be what would have an impact on stopping lynching. I just lost my place. Sorry, I just did something funny. She accumulated many enemies for her positions, and she carried a pistol with her everywhere she went out of fear for her life. She was criticized for not knowing her place. Some of her black contemporaries argued that her writing was unbecoming of a lady and that she would do well to practice more patience and moderation and conservatism. The white press tried to discredit her as an immoral woman, but the continued attacks on black womanhood also formed the backbone of a new movement of black club women who rallied to the defense of Ida and took on the organizing of national meetings against lynching and against rape. At a national gathering in Boston in 1895, the National Federation of African American Women was founded. Ida B. Wells was not present at this meeting. She was newly married. She was expecting her first child. This is just an anecdote, but she was one of the first women to refuse to give up her name during when she got married, which I just think is an indication of her feminism. Finally, her crusade was reaching wider organizations, but there were debates that Wells would ultimately find herself frustrated by and marginalized her influence. Although many black club women supported the campaign against rape and lynching, they felt her course of action was too aggressive and too confrontational. People thought it would do more harm than good to the movement, and that it would make their arguments less palatable to the whites who did support their cause. The argument was that it would be misread as condoning rape to argue that it was a lie that black men raped white women. Instead, they adopted a campaign calling for the protection of black women instead of defend black men and black women. Josephine St. Pierre Ruffin, who was one of the leaders of this black, this newly formed National Black Club Women Association, explains the campaign. She said, "With an army of organized women standing for purity and mental worth, black women could now break the silence, not by noisy protestations of what we are not, but by dignified showing of what we hope to become." The arguments that black women would make change by modeling what true womanhood is, and that they too are deserving of protection, just like white women. This incensed Ida B. Wells. She was insistent that armed resistance and agitation for federal intervention were the only things that would guarantee protection and the possibility of black progress. The National Association of Colored Women merged with another black women's club to form the National Association of Colored Women, a new National Association of Colored Women in 1896, led by Mary Church Terrell. The lynching of black men and rape and the rape of black women remained a weekly event in the South, and the assault on the moral character of black women also continued. In this same time period, Booker T. Washington, who took over the Tuskegee Institute after Frederick Douglass died, delivered what became known as the Atlanta Compromise Speech, where he fully supported a position of separate but equal that would very soon become the new law, federal law. He said, "In all things that are purely social, we can be as separate as the fingers, yet one as the hand in all things essential to mutual progress." And unfortunately, the National Association of Colored Women became very closely allied with the conservative politics of Booker T. Washington, who argued that through conservative posture and patience, the causes would be advanced. More radical members like Ida B. Wells were isolated, and they were forced to find other organizations that better suited their tactics and their politics. It was very hard to operate within that context. This is a quote from Ida B. Wells about Booker T. Washington. She said, "Mr. Washington says in substance, give me money to educate the Negro, and when he is taught how to work, he will not commit the crime of lynching, but that he will not commit the crime for which lynching is done. Mr. Washington knows when he says this that lynching is not invoked to punish crime, but to punish color, and not even industrial education will change that." Wells continued her campaign, finally establishing an anti-lynching bureau for federal investigation in 1914 through the NAACP. Black women led a surge in organizing by focusing on the racial and sexual politics of the South far before the demand took on a national character, and they actually anticipated the demands of the movement that was to come. Ida B. Wells not only participated in black women's clubs and civil rights organizations of her day, she was also a suffragist, and she aimed to argue that black women should be included in the call for suffrage. In the early days of the suffrage movement, the Seneca Falls Convention of Women's Rights in 1848 was inspired by the abolitionist struggle. They delivered discovered similarities that linked chattel slavery and women's oppression. Neither were given any legal rights. A woman belonged to her husband. Only a husband could file for divorce, and in that case, he was able to keep any property and any children in his own possession. Women couldn't vote or engage political activity, and legally, they actually weren't even supposed to be allowed to speak in public. Even though the movement for voting rights is thought of as a white middle class movement, many black women were actively involved and aimed to shape it. The post-Reconstruction era opened up possibilities for autonomy for women that never existed before, and Wells herself was very much a product of this, though the defining edge of the product, I would say. Women sought to define themselves not as true women, but as they wanted to define themselves not as I'm a true woman who deserves protection, but I'm a human being and I have agency and I'm going to act too. The movement so lent itself to making connections with anti-racism, but unfortunately the dominant forces were to fail in that regard. Wells had very public debates with Susan B. Anthony and Mary Walton, who were some of the leading white suffragists of the time, about whether including black women strengthened or weakened the fight for suffrage. In the lead up to the national demonstration demanding full suffrage for women in 1913, a debate took place about whether black women should be allowed to even join the march in DC. And ultimately a segregated march was decided on with black women at the back. And Ida B. Wells was so pissed. As soon as the march started, she just jumped right in at the very front, refusing to concede that she should be at the back of the march. And that was the kind of fighter that Ida B. Wells was. She refused to give in to the dominant arguments. She was always pushing the envelope. She was always fighting for what she thought was going to actually bring the struggle forward. She never saw her crusade for lynching acknowledged in the form of federal legislation. With race riots and a spike in lynchings as the background, the anti-lynching campaign quickly became the heart of a national civil rights organizing that culminated in the Dyer anti-lynching bill put forward in 1922. Even though it was defeated, it marked a shift in broader forces, that there were actually broader forces that were beginning to embrace Ida B. Wells' politics and ultimately would embrace her more radical tactics. In so many ways, Ida B. Wells' politics were ahead of her times. The violence she experienced in the South turned her into a lifelong radical, a feminist, a civil rights activist, and an organizer until the very end. She insisted that there could be no change so long as African Americans were denied full equality in exercising their political rights, and she challenged every notion of what a proper woman is supposed to be. Her disposition did put her at odds with a lot of her political contemporaries. She was renowned for her stubbornness and for her refusal to compromise on the insistence of the need for protest. Despite being difficult and often isolated in new political dynamics in a lot of ways, she always, always held the radical plank of the movement her entire life. Her strategies would later become widespread as the escalation of white terror and segregation provoked the civil rights movement. After World War II, the confrontational activist approach is very much what led to the gains of the civil rights movement. In 2005, 74 years after Ida B. Wells' death, the US Congress honored her and apologized for never passing anti-lynching legislation. And I just really wish I could read what she would have to say about those contradictions and that hypocrisy if she was still alive.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.